105.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for Black Star News coming up real shortly. Just wanted to mention again is that if you appreciate the programming that you get here on a daily basis, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 212-209-2950 or go to give to WBAI.org online. That's 212-209-2950 or give to the number 2 WBAI.org online. It is now 3 p.m. Stay tuned for Black Star News coming up.
Yes, yes, sisters and brothers, welcome to Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM New York, also streaming on WBAI.org. I'm your host, Milton Alimadi, joined as always by my comrade, friend, colleague, managing editor of Black Star News, co-host Colin Benjamin.
Good afternoon, comrade. How are you doing? You ready for the two storms? Or?
Yes, that's the thing I wanted to ask you. You know, I see it's snowing outside. And my big question to you is, what is a tropical man like you doing?
In this I ask myself this days like these. Yes, yes,
even though it's not even a fair question, since I come from deeper into the equator.
See, exactly. You are along the line there. Yep, yep, yep.
Yes,
yep.
Yes. This is our modern world, man. So anyway, we have a nice, good show today, a very serious show, actually. Always our shows are serious, and we're able to do this because of your support. We love this station. We know you love this station as well. Where else can you have any conversation that you deem is worthy without worrying about the bottom line? Can you imagine these major corporate newspapers, you know, regardless of what they say about independence and objectivity, yeah. It is impossible. Once you have advertising and sponsorship dictating the terms, of course, they must be conscious of that, regardless of what they tell you. The editors, you know, reporters could be 100% wanting to do the job, but of course, editors have to be mindful because who cuts the check? The publishers, the owner of the media company. So we never take this for granted, sisters and brothers. We appreciate your support. We love this station. We know you love it too. So please, please, please remember the magic number, 212-209-2950. That is how you can support WBAI. You can adopt our show as a buddy as well. Any amount that you designate will be taken from your credit or debit card on a monthly basis. You can do that by going to give, and then the number 2, and then WBAI.org. Without further ado, we'd like to introduce this week's guest. I would like to read his bio, Frank Chapman. Frank Chapman was wrongfully convicted of murder and armed robbery in 1961 and sentenced to life plus 50 years. In the Missouri State Prison. His case was taken up by the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, NAARPR, in 1973. And in 1976, he was released. He had been incarcerated for 14 years. In 1983, he was elected executive director of NAARPR. He worked with Charlene Mitchell, who preceded him as executive director of NAARPR. on building an international campaign to free Reverend Ben Chavez and the Wilmington 10, Joanne Little, and others falsely accused and politically persecuted. In 1979, Chapman became a founding member of the U.S. Peace Council and was elected to its national board. He was part of the international campaign to free Nelson Mandela, been a part of leading the struggle in Chicago for community control of the police. And that is why he is joining us today. He's been doing it for the past 10 years to stop police crimes, especially murder, torture, beatings, and racial profiling. He is presently executive director of the refounded National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. He is part of the Empowering Communities for Public Safety Coalition, ECPS, which crafted the ECPS ordinance. He is involved in political education campaign to help those who participated in the recent municipal elections in Chicago to elect district councilors in the 22 police districts in the city of Chicago. And he will be talking about that in addition to other things. This will be the first time ever citizens have been given the opportunity to monitor the police and make policies regarding how their communities are policed. And that is why we would like to hear from him. So we see if there are national lessons, including for here in New York City. Chapman recently published his memoirs, The Damned Don't Cry, Pages from the Life of a Black Prisoner and Organizer. Welcome to Black Star News Show, Frank Chapman.
Unmute.
I think you have to unmute. This is not
I do.
Is not the 1960s technology, brother. We are in the 21st
century. I'm not. I lived in the 1960s, but I'm not living in the time.
We caught you. We know you like throwing those one-liners, but this time we ambushed you and caught you right in the head. All right. Welcome.
Glad to be here. What an honor.
Great. Go ahead.
I've been a fan of WBAI since the 70s. Thank you.
So, there's so much to talk about. I mean, first of all, I did read your bio, your introduction. What do people still need to know to get a little more feel for you? What I read was coming from text. You know, tell us just a little bit about yourself. Then let's get into the meat of the matter. What is left out of the bio that people should know to know who Frank Chapman is?
Well, I've been engaged in the struggle around prison reform, freeing of political prisoners, and dealing with community control of the police for damn near 60 years. Because I started being involved in this in 1961 when I first went to prison. Sometimes I don't realize how long I've been doing this. I've been doing it a long time, and there have been some very special moments in the struggle. And one of those special moments for me was when I came home in 76, I met Bill Hampton, Fred Hampton's brother. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Fred Hampton was the chairman of the Black Panther Party here in the state of Illinois.
Yes, of course.
And he had just, he hadn't been too long ago assassinated. I got out in 76. He was assassinated in 69. So that was, just 8 years before I came home. And his brother was still fighting for justice for Fred. So anyway, I became familiar with this struggle that we're now engaged in through Fred Hampton's brother and Fred Hampton, you know.
Right.
And I like to always pay tribute to that because he's the comrade who started fight for community control of the police here in Chicago. And we still carry that fight on in his honor.
Right. And just to jump on that for a minute, and what really impresses me the most when I look at that is the really young age that the young comrades were engaged at that period. I want to get back to that issue, and that's going to be one of my questions, but I want it to come a little later. One of the most immediate things that you have been involved in is what I mentioned in the introduction in terms of this recent election to set up this body that would include elected members of the public to be in a position to monitor and even contribute towards setting policy of policing in their communities. Talk a little bit about that and then tell us the outcome of that particular election. We know the incumbent mayor lost. There's going to be a runoff. She's not going to be part of it, but we can get into that later. Tell us first about the council itself. What is it supposed to do, and how does it look now after the recent election?
Thank you very much for that question. On the 28th of February, for the first time in the history of this country, people of Chicago elected people into police district councils in 22 police districts to serve as community representatives with the power to hold police accountable for what they do and what they don't do. This is not a toothless council. This council has the power to hold the police accountable. And the way in which they are going to do that is they're going to nominate 14 people for a citywide commission. Now, from that 14 people, whoever is the mayor will have to select or appoint 7 of those people to be on the citywide commission. 2 from the south side of Chicago, 2 from the west side of Chicago, and 2 from the north side of Chicago, and 1 at large.
Okay.
This citywide commission is empowered by the ordinance that we forced the city administration to pass in 2021. They will have oversight over all police policies. And not only oversight, but they will also have the ability to initiate policies that we think should be policies. They will also have the power to call into question and to eliminate policies which are in blatant violation of our constitutional rights, but which have been a longstanding practice by the police in Chicago. For example, torturing people. For example, shooting unarmed people in the back, or shooting unarmed people, period. Racial profiling. All these things will come under a new review and examination, and where policies need to be changed to protect the rights of the people, those policies will be changed. Nothing like this has ever happened, to my knowledge.
Okay, so let me interrupt you a little bit. When you say nothing like this has ever happened, many cities, urban areas in this country, there is a police civilian commission review board of some sort in all of these cities. But you're saying the difference is that this one actually includes elected people and are not appointed by mayors or any other officials, so they are therefore relatively much more independent. And that's the key difference. Is that what you're saying?
That's the key difference, and that is also the mechanism for self-empowerment in our community. Yeah, that's the key difference.
Okay, now two quick questions. Give us an example. You did speak broadly about, of course, shooting people in the back and whatnot, and all of those kind of examples. Give us another example of a policy that people in Chicago want to be addressed very quickly, number one. And then you spoke about accountability. Give us an example of how accountability would look in a different form that it does not exist today.
Okay. Well, first I'll speak on the policy that the interim commission is currently addressing. That's the gang database, which you are familiar with there in New York City. We have literally stopped the police from implementing this racist policy that has been going on for years in terms of the gang database. And we got that on hold right now as we speak. And we are going to make some changes in that. They're not going to be able to continue that policy. We're going to stop that. Now, with regard to, let's say, a police crime being committed.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know.
And give us an example of a police crime, too.
Okay. An example of a police crime is like what happened in the Laquan McDonald case.
Right. Right.
He was shot 16 times. The first two shots, he hit the ground. This was a 17-year-old child. And then 14 shots was fired into his body while he lay there defenseless on the ground. Now, we were able to get that police officer indicted and charged with murder. But most police officers who do this never get indicted. They never even get a true bill against them. The cases are not really seriously investigated. So the police in Chicago historically have not been held accountable for crimes, no matter how gross, heinous those crimes may be. We're going to stop that.
So you're saying they're more likely to be indicted in a case like that now going forward.
Yeah. We're going to say that going forward they will be held accountable. We're making that commitment.
I know Brother Colin has several questions as well. Let me just ask you one more before I get to Colin. Tell us briefly, what was the reaction of the police union when this issue was even first being debated, way before even the election of this?
They were furious. They were saying that what we were getting ready to do in Chicago was put criminals in charge of policing. Well, they already have that. So they were wrong on that score. But they were furious. And so when once the law got passed and once it became a fact that we were going to implement this law, they ran candidates to be on these councils to counter us, because right. they wanted to undermine and torpedo the ability of the councils to implement the law. They did this without any shame. Here's a law that they were diametrically opposed to. Now that the law has gotten passed,
right.
they're going to endorse and sponsor candidates to be on the council. Well, we know what that's all about. That's to stop the council from doing what it's doing. We defeated them.
Were they able to get any of their candidates elected?
Yes, they were, in three police districts.
Okay.
Where mostly police live in those districts.
Right. So out of 66, they were able to get three people.
They got three districts where they have the majority of the representatives in those three districts.
Oh, out of 22 districts.
Out of 22 districts, yeah.
Okay, understood.
We have, in terms of our movement, we have 13 districts in which we have, we have 14 districts in which we have a majority of the representatives of those districts, and we have 9 districts in which we have all three representatives, 9 districts. So we won, you know, we overwhelmingly defeated the FOP in their bid to undermine us and torpedo the implementation of this law.
All right, thank you, Colin Benjamin.
Wow, so you hand it over to me after you cannibalized several of my questions. But Mr. Chapman, thank you again for being with us. So I understand that the mayor will have veto power over determinations and decisions made by these council, but the veto can be overridden by the city council, right? So go into that a little bit for us.
Well, that was one of the things, that's one part of the bill that we disagree with, and we were not able to get it in. We negotiated this bill, so we lost that in the negotiations. But we have a referendum coming up that we're going to put on the ballot in the next election process, where we will eliminate that power on the part of the mayor in that referendum. We're gonna put that before the voters of Chicago. Let the voters of Chicago decide that.
And when is that again?
Well, we're gonna try to have it in the next election, next municipal elections.
All right. So now, what about people that say the incumbent mayor lost because she was perceived as someone who was not doing enough in terms of addressing the issue of crime, and that would lend argument to those that say this kind of entity that's just being elected would indeed tie the hands of the police? How do you address people that have been raising those kind of questions? What do you tell them?
Well, what we tell them is that this ordinance, as it is being implemented, does not tie the hand of the police. It ties the hand of police criminals.
Mm-hmm.
It ties the hands of police who have been abusive of their power,
mm-hmm.
who have been violating our constitutional rights, and it ties the hands of the racist FOP union, police mm-hmm. union, which is openly racist. You know, it ties their hands so that their policies of defending murderers will no longer exist. The police have the only union that I know of. I don't know of no other union in the United States that can do this, that raises money to defend a union member who's been indicted for murder.
Right.
Who else does that?
Right. And we have an example here, and I'm sure you have many examples there. We have an example. We have many examples here, but one in particular, Eric Garner. I'm sure you're familiar with that case.
I'm very familiar with
it. Individual who was basically lynched by an officer named Pantaleo, using his arm as a noose, choked him to death. And we had the union leader, the police union leader, whose name ironically is also Lynch, saying that was a legal, and that he acted properly in mm-hmm. that procedure. Standing before the cameras and just saying that callously, with total disregard. So going back to the exact thing that you just said, and I'm sure you have many examples of cases like that in Chicago.
Yeah. Well, you know, these are the type of things that brought about the movement, that brought about the passing of this law to begin with. You know, we want justice in our community, you know, and we know that racist police who have no regard, no respect for the rights of Black people are not going to give us that justice. So this ordinance is about getting rid of them and putting policing in the hands of the community that has been abused by the police. So that's why the FOP hates this, because it's about putting power in the hands of those who have been abused and violated by the police.
And the automatic way to demonize people who ask for accountability and police involvement is to say that, quote unquote, you want to be soft on crime. That's how you're demonized, as if by asking for accountability, you're saying, oh, you don't mind that crime does occur. I want you to address that for a minute.
Well, you know, this shows you how far brainwashing has went with some people with regard to policing in this country when it comes to Black folks. I would say the police are soft on crime. Mm. Why would I say that? Because in Chicago, I don't know what they're doing in New York City, but in Chicago, they openly work with drug dealers, drug pushers. Mm-hmm. They openly do this. You can see them doing it. People in the community know that they're doing it, because they allow these people to control the corners for a certain period of the day where they're obviously distributing drugs. So they're openly doing this here. And we have a homicide rate in the Black community, which has also something to do with the drug problem. We have a homicide rate where 70% of the homicides are unsolved. But on the other hand, we have a record number of people who have been tortured by the Chicago police, particularly under the John Birch police officer, commander. I mean, in the hundreds that have been sent to prison for these murders that they did not commit, which means that the murderers are still on the streets. So, I mean, you could argue from that factual information that the police are soft on crime, because they sure in the hell ain't been solving a lot of crimes in the black community. You know, they're not there to solve crimes. They're there to control the population. They're there to keep down unrest. That's what they're there for. They function in our community like an occupying order, which has nothing to do with controlling crime.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, live streaming on WBAI.org. I'm your host, Milton Alimadi, joined as always by my comrade, managing editor of Black Star News, Colin Benjamin. Our guest today is Frank Chapman. He's an activist, particularly on the issue of police community control of policing in terms of being able to monitor the police, in terms of actually making input into how policing is conducted. And we are having this conversation because this is a listener-supported station. This is not a corporate station where we would have to be concerned about the bottom line and pick and choose the kind of conversations that we can bring to you, the listener. So you, the listener, have control by supporting the station. And at this point, I remind you once again, the magic number is 212-209-2950. Any support that you give to WBAI will be put to good use. You can also select any one of our shows, including Black Star News Show, of course, as a buddy, in which case any amount that you designate will be taken out of your credit or debit card on a monthly basis. You can do that by going to give and then the number 2, WBAI.org. Back to our conversation. Colin Benjamin.
Mr. Chapman, speak to us about what COPPA is and also talk about how these councils, you know, how you see it interacting with COPPA and also accountability in terms of the higher up in the police brass, the superintendents and such.
Okay. The Chicago Alliance Against Race and Political Repression is a mass defense organization. Our primary reason for being is that we defend the rights of our people. We came into existence to defend the rights of the Black Liberation Movement, to be a movement, to organize and protest against the system of racist oppression. So we are a mass organization which defends the rights of our people to organize and protest against the status quo, against our racist oppressors. And we know that those rights are being violated all the time. You know, in the past, they were violated vigorously with the arrest of a lot of freedom fighters, with the murder of freedom fighters, with the Black Panther Party and others. So we've also been involved over the years in the struggle to free political prisoners. We're still involved in that struggle. Today, a lot of the political prisoners, we wouldn't have called them political prisoners back in the 60s, but today I think we should call them political prisoners. And that is people who have been wrongfully convicted, people who have been tortured and forced to confess to crimes that they did not commit, you know. Like what we have going on here in the state of Illinois. So we exist to defend the rights of those people, to bring about mass action to get their freedom and to stop the state in its attempts to carry out this suppression of our movements. in some cases, the elimination of our movements. You know, so that's why we're here. That's why we exist. And over the years, we've become more and more focused on the question of police crimes, because the police have been denying our people organizing space to fight the status quo.
Give us some examples.
Well, the example is mass incarceration. What happens as a result of mass incarceration? What happens as a result of mass incarceration? I don't know about in New York, but in many states throughout the country, people are denied the right, they can't vote.
Right.
And they're given the stigma of being criminals, where they can't get jobs and so forth.
Right.
So it forces them into a recycling.
Right.
You know, where right. they're constantly going back into prison. This hampers our movement.
Correct.
Because these are young people that could be involved in organizing and in protesting against the conditions that that dehumanize us.
Correct.
So so you're denying them that opportunity by putting them in jail or by killing them.
Right.
You know, and when you shoot them, you know, I gave an example one time in the Juan McDonald case. You know, I said, I'm old enough to remember when they were shooting Black Panthers down on the streets like dogs, you know. They shoot somebody like a Laquan McDonald 17 times, and people don't automatically see that. They see it as a lynching, it's clearly that, but they don't automatically see it as an act of political repression, like they would in the case of Munchie Carter, who got killed in L.A. But we see it as that because this is terroristic intimidation.
Correct.
To keep our people from daring to organize.
Right.
From daring to do something, you know.
So this is what will happen to you.
Yeah. And so the repression today is even more intense. The repression today reminds me of the lynch era, you know, the era of lynching. And whatever was the main mechanism of social control. Because, you know, now instead of people getting their picnic baskets and whatnot and going out to a lynching, they're watching it on video. You know, with the George Floyd case, you know, and all the other cases, the cases that just not happened in Memphis, you know, they're watching our people being legally lynched by the police, quote unquote legally, you know. But so, you know, this kind of repression, this kind of fascistic like terror, this keeps people from organizing. This instills fear in people, you know. And that's what they want to do. They want people to be so afraid and they dare not move. So that's what I mean when I say they are denying us organizing space.
Understood. No, you made it very clear. I think Carlin had a second part of the question in terms of the relation of the organization with the city council, Carlin.
And also with, you know, the brass, like will the councils also have power to go after, let's say, corrupt, you know,
police commanders,
superintendents, that type of stuff?
Yes, they will. But that's going to be, we don't want to create any illusions. Like Anacard Brown said, don't tell no lies if they know you're the biggest.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite quotes from Cabral as well.
Well, now's a chance. Now I have an opportunity to apply it. We have an opportunity to go after them. That's going to be a struggle.
Okay.
That's going to be a struggle. Here's how we have that opportunity. Because the Civilian Office of Police Accountability, we will have the power to hire and fire who is over that investigative body. That's an investigative body.
Okay.
So we can use that investigative body to look into the types of questions that you're talking about, you know,
and to bring
these cops up for censorship. But we need some cooperation between the city council and the mayor, you know, to make this work, you know. And that's where the struggle comes in at, because there are members of the city council, and they're pretty obvious. There are members of the city council who do not want to hold the police accountable.
Right.
There are members of the city council who will be there to defend those commanders and whatnot when they're brought up for censorship, particularly right. the superintendent of police, because that's who right. we really that's who we really want to be able to have power to say you're fired. You know,
understood.
And, and we don't have that now. If this referendum passes, we will have that. But we're still fighting for that.
All right. So Brother Chapman, we are taking a short break here. So Engineer Reggie can play us a little bit of African tunes here, and we'll continue with the second half of the program. Sisters and brothers, welcome to the second half hour of Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM New York, also streaming on WBAI.org. I'm your host, Milton Alimadi, joined as always by my comrade, managing editor of Black Star News, Colin Benjamin. And our guest today is a Chicago-based activist, Brother Frank Chapman. And it's been telling us about the efforts that they have made to put in place effective police community accountability, one that involves elected members of the public, so they're relatively independent, unlike the entities that we have in many other cities, including right here in New York, where those individuals are appointed by the politicians. So that is why Brother Chapman is telling us that this is a unique project that has just been put in place in Chicago. And obviously, it will have national interest to people that have been fighting for police accountability, community accountability in all the urban areas in the United States. So welcome to the second half hour of our conversation with Chapman. I wanted to ask you something that you actually said that slipped my mind. You said the people that we call political prisoners today would not have been referred to as political prisoners in the 1960s. What did you mean by that? Could you elaborate?
Well, political prisoners in the 60s were people who were directly connected with the movement, you know. You know, they were either civil rights activists who were working with Dr. Martin Luther King, or they were people like members of the Black Panther Party, like Huey P. Newton, Assata Shakur, and others who were obviously being sought out by the FBI, prosecuted and persecuted because of their political belief. Or they were people like Angela Davis, who was clearly sought out by Ronald Reagan, being a member of the Communist Party. So that's what I mean. People who were actively engaged in political work being targeted in the 60s not only for imprisonment and brutality, but for now out-and-out murder. For example, in the Fred Hampton case, you know, we might have some doubts. Some people might have some doubts about Martin Luther King. We don't have no doubts about it. It's hard to prove that Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated at the behest of the FBI. Same thing with Malcolm X, which it would involve the FBI and the CIA. But that's not true with Fred Hampton. That's not true with Fred Hampton. With Fred Hampton, we know, and they admit that this was a political assassination coordinated and organized by the FBI and Chicago Police Department. That's as clear as day, you know? Right. And so this is what I'm talking about.
Understood. Although in other cases that it would not be surprising if evidence does emerge.
Yeah.
For example, in Malcolm X's case, there's a lot that, you know, we realize is unknown. And in fact, it's going to be a subject of one of our future conversations.
There's an investigation going on, right? There's an investigation going on right now. With regard to Malik El-Shabazz.
Right.
There's an investigation going on right now.
Right. Now, to stick with that same theme, it's actually one of the things I wanted to ask you as well. Now, in terms of the struggle in the 1960s, the people involved in the struggle, the freedom fighters, the liberation fighters, they had a vision of how to change the society. They were challenging capital. They were envisioning the possibility of creating a different society in the United States. And that went hand in hand with the struggle. And police brutality and resisting that was just one component of the overall struggle, correct?
That's correct.
So now my question to you is this. The contemporary struggle that we're involved in, and police brutality being one aspect of that, don't you see a missing element? Are we asking for a different vision? Are we envisioning a different type of United States? Is there an ideological component today as it existed in the 1960s? Do you see that? What's your observation of that?
I even wrote a booklet on it.
Okay. The floor is yours. Expand, elaborate.
I would refer some people, let me reference this. Let me tell some people in case they haven't done it, to check out State and Revolution by Lincoln. You cannot separate the police and police and powers from the state. It's an agency of the state. That's what it is. And you can't talk about police reform or community control of police or any of that without at the same time talking about Black liberation. And you can't talk about Black liberation, really having it, without talking about a fundamental transformation and change in the society brought about by the oppressed people, not brought about by some legislative reform, not brought about by President Biden passing the George Floyd bill, not brought about by any of that, but brought about by an uprising of the people. Involving workers and nationally oppressed people like Black people, you know. All of that is in our purview, you know. I talk about it in the book that I just wrote called Black Liberation and Socialism, you know. Also, I talk about it in my memoirs, you know, The Damn Don't Cry, Pages from the Life of a Black Prisoner. I'm a socialist and a revolutionary. And so I approach these questions just like you raised them. You know, I don't see policing as being something outside of and divorced from our struggle to bring about fundamental changes in this society, bring about revolutionary changes. I don't see it. I see the revolutionary process involving the struggle against police repression But it doesn't end there. In fact, that's just the start, you know, because why are we trying to get rid of police repression? It's so that we can create a pathway to revolution. Now, if you don't believe that, then you're not on our side of the barricades, you know, because that's how we're thinking about this.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in and you wanted to maybe post some questions for our guest today, the number to dial is 212-209-2877. And Engineer Reggie will let me know once we have any listeners on the line wanting to ask some questions. Brother Colin Benjamin.
Yes. Since the election or selection of Donald Trump, crime in Chicago has basically, you know, become synonymous, you know, because of the Republicans, right? But, you know, you're a longtime activist there. Speak on the social issues that you see that are not being addressed that are really the main contributors of, you know, the crime issue in Chicago.
Yeah, and I want to add to that same question that, Brother Colin just said. We always hear mayors talking about crime statistics. Rarely do they come out to talk about unemployment statistics, poverty statistics. So please.
Yeah, unemployment. Okay,
that's another hour. But in this hour, I think I can address some basic issues here. The biggest crime wave in Chicago is the crime of poverty. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't see that as a crime. Let me just talk about it in relationship to the black community. Not only is the unemployment rate above 50% for our youth, you know, but that's damn near for the whole entire black community in Chicago right now. Mm-hmm. And in 2008, you had the greatest transfer of wealth in the history of this country in terms of black folks, black homeowners. They lost tremendously here. The biggest landlord on the south side of Chicago is Chase Bank. You know, people don't generally view these as crimes, but when you drive down towards the loop or drive down the streets that intersect with the loop, you see homeless people, people living under bridges, people living in tents alongside the highway. You know, back during the Depression, they used to call them Hoovervilles. Well, we got Hoovervilles again, you know. And every political party, Democrats and Republicans, you know, have tolerated this. They've done nothing about it. They spend billions and billions of dollars on foreign wars and aggressions, mm-hmm. but they don't do nothing about these problems, about right. these problems. And we're looking at them problems every day. You know, the black community and the brown community and white working class communities are deeply scarred by these economic problems that I'm talking about. And it's unemployment, you know, it's poor housing. Mm-hmm. Or no housing, right. And it's also a genocidal lack of healthcare programs. You know, mm-hmm. like for example, 70% of our people in this city—I'm not making up these statistics. 70% of our people in this city, black people, I'm talking about, died from COVID. Mm-hmm. In the early stages of an epidemic, it knocked out 70% of our people. You know, I mean, 70%—not 70% of our people, but 70% of the people who died.
Were
black.
Yeah, that's what you meant. I understood. We have a caller or two, so let's take
Now, these are crimes of government against our people, you know.
Absolutely. You know, we're going to have you back for part two for sure. But let's take a question or two while you're with us. Yes. Caller, you're on the line. What is your name? Where are you calling from? What part of the city? And what is your question? Let's keep it short, please.
Okay, my name is Rafik. I'm calling from Brooklyn. I wanted to ask the brother if along with the issues that they're raising around police brutality, et cetera, do they have an idea of how they might implement, maybe on a national or on a a state level, have whenever the police have to pay out to people that they families that they killed somebody,
right?
It comes out of the police's pension. It should not be on the backs of the taxpayers when we're the ones paying for the bullets and the salaries of these people, and then we got to pay the hit when they kill somebody. Want to pay them as an appeasement? Is there a thing going on regarding coming out of their pension rather than the taxpayers? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Carla. Let our guests answer that.
I agree with the caller. It should. And we're going to be working on things like that here in Chicago. We've been saying it all the time. This city has paid out more than $500 million in civil suits against the police. Not to bring the police to justice, but to buy off the victim. And so there's no justice there, We fought to get reparations passed in the city council for the victims of police torture. We were successful in getting those reparations passed, and Chicago, I think, is the only city that has a torture justice center as a result of that. Is that adequate? No, that's not adequate. It's definitely not adequate. And it doesn't address the issue that the brother just raised, caller just raised here. This definitely should come out of the police's salary, but we don't want to give them no more salary.
All right, let's take the second caller. Hey. Caller, your name, where are you calling from, and your question. Keep it brief, please.
Okay, it's Russ up in White Plains, and I'd like to let you guests know New York poverty among Chinese is greater than the poverty among black people, and the crime rate is obviously quite different. Number one, what does he think about that? And number two, is the only political prisoners of the 60s that are being released are those that admit their participation? Does he think that Leonard Peltier and Mumia will ever be released unless they admit their participation? Thank you.
Well, I'd like to take the first part. He's the longest held political prisoner in the United States, Leonard Peltier. We took his case up back in the 70s, and we're still working with his people. We have to build a very powerful movement to make that happen. We thought it almost might have happened under Obama, but we were wrong. The only way he's going to get released is for some kind of presidential pardon, because his case has been legally exhausted in the courts. So we have to continue to build a movement, and hopefully that movement will become more powerful, because that's the only thing that can get him out now. He can't. There's no court. I don't think there's any court procedure left. I don't never say no, we can't get nobody out. I say we have to build a better, bigger and stronger movement.
The caller had another part of the question. I didn't understand it, but did you? And if you want to respond to that.
Something about the Chinese?
The Asian community, right.
Oh, the Asian community? Okay. Well, the Asian community is not like the black community. And I think that's pretty obvious. There's no community in the United States like black community, because there's no community in the United States that has a 250-year legacy of slavery.
Not only that,
but we are a nationally oppressed people.
Correct. And so that's why the question was confusing to me. I mean, we are today because of history. History cannot just be erased conveniently. It's interesting how, Europeans always, invoke the history when it's convenient. But when it comes to Africans, people of African descent, your history is irrelevant with your contemporary condition. Let's go to the third caller. Caller, your name, where you're calling from, and your question.
No more.
No more callers? No more. Okay, very good. All right, so we're running out of time anyway. Our listeners, once again, it is because of your support that we were able to have this type of enlightening conversation. And that is why we really love the station. And we only have this station because of your support. It is 100% listener supported. Please, the magic number one more time. 212-209-2950. Call that magic number so we can have this brother, Frank Chapman, back to drop more knowledge. 212-209-2950. Any support you give to WBAI will help us do these types of programs. You can also adopt us as a buddy by going to give and then the number 2 and then WBAI.org, in which case the amount that you designate will be taken from your debit or credit card. Frank Chapman, tell us how listeners can get in touch with you to continue this conversation offline. And more importantly, tell listeners how they can get your book. Repeat the titles and let them know how they can get your book so that if they want, they can also become like you. Go yes, ahead. In the 1 minute we have left.
1 minute. Okay, 1 minute you can get my book online. Damn, Don't Cry. Pages from the Life of a Black Prison Organizer. This is a new edition that just came out yesterday. It might not be online yet, so you should be in touch with International Publishers, 235 West 23rd Street. That's right there in New York City.
And your email or phone number, whatever you're comfortable giving out.
Well, my email is Chapman Frank, C-H-A-P-M-A-N, Frank, F-R-A-N-K, 74@gmail.com.
Listeners, you can follow me at Ali Mahdi. Also, make sure you check out blackstarnews.com. Call in. Your contact?
Colin1L_B30@Yahoo.
Sisters and brothers, that was our guest, Frank Chapman, and we guarantee you that this was part one of a series. Part one of a series. This is only the beginning. Remain Pan-African. Stay healthy. Stay strong. See you soon. That's all the time we have today. Bye.
Listener sponsored WBAI in New York with a moment in women's history. Shirley Chisholm was the first Black woman in Congress, and in 1972, she became the first woman and first Black American to seek the nomination for President of the United States from one of the two major parties.
I am a woman with ability, with intelligence, and with depth. That is the sadness about this country. And that's why I made my mind up. I was going to stay in this race, come thick or thin. And I was going to go all the way to Miami, because even though the papers have been underscoring me, even though many people have been saying, well, she can't be serious, they're going to see me in action at the National Convention. And I mean this. I am committed to this as an instrument of people in this country who've been left out, an instrument of people whose counsel and advice has never been sought. In terms of putting a ticket together, only using the people every 4 years for their votes. I look at all of these distinguished senators telling all of the people what they're going to do for women, what they're going to do for Blacks, what they're going to do for Chicanos, what they're going to do for this group and the other group. Well, darn it, they've been in the United States Senate for 10 or more years. If they had a concern about the American Indian, they would have done something already about the miserable living conditions that those Indians live on in terms of the reservations, where 70% of them don't live to see the age of 40. They don't have a concern about women. They don't have a concern about the conservation and preservation of human resources. They're only interested in these human resources every 4 years when it's time to go out and get the vote. And that's why when people say, well, what makes you so different from all the rest of them? I said, I am different because I have a gut commitment to people, first of all. All of the rest of them have commitment to different interest groups, financial groups, power groups. I'm espoused only by a lot of folks in the country who told me they didn't want to vote between the lesser of the two evils anymore. They wanted to give their vote to somebody that they knew deep down within themselves had a commitment to people. And for whatever that vote would mean, at least it would give me that much more added strength that I need when I get to the convention.
Chisholm retired from Congress after serving 7 terms. In 1983, she said she wanted to be remembered as a woman who dared to be a catalyst for change. You can receive our Women's History audio collection with Shirley Chisholm and other trailblazers by becoming a WBAI buddy, a sustaining member for $15 a month. You'll also receive our fabulous tote bag. Please go to women.wbai.org. Again, that's women.wbai.org to become a buddy in the name of your favorite program. Or call 212-209-209.